You're listening to GDA Podcast, powered by GDA Speakers, now available on iTunes and all other podcast platforms, with new episodes every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. GDA Podcast showcases insightful conversations from the best thought leaders, educators, policy experts, motivators, and storytellers on the keynote speaking circuit today. Want today's guest at your next event? Call GDA Speakers at 214-420-1999 or visit gdaspeakers.com. And now, here's this episode of GDA Podcast with hosts Scale and Kyle Davis. Enjoy.
Fair enough.
Our guest on today's episode of GDA Podcast is Troy Hazard. There are few situations in the business world that Troy has not experienced and survived. He is a serial entrepreneur who has founded and nurtured 12 businesses over two decades and has consulted to countless successful companies around the world over the last 25 years. He has also been a leader of leaders, having served as the international president of the Elite EO Entrepreneur Organization on their global board. Troy now shares his experiences through his speaking engagements, his television talk show, and his books. His most recent, Future Proofing Your Business, is an Amazon business bestseller. Welcome to GDA Podcast, Troy.
Hey, Troy.
Thanks for the invite.
Well, it's glad to have somebody who has an accent. Where are you from?
Just to mix it up. Just to mix it up.
Yeah. So for people who don't know who you are, me being one of those people, if you could kind of, you know, catch us up to speed and let us know who Troy is, I think the listeners would appreciate that.
Yeah, for sure. Look, I have an unusual start into private enterprise. And as an entrepreneur, I actually got fired from a radio station back in the late 80s. I walked into my boss and said, look, I've been working 18-hour days for the last 6 months. I either need a raise or I need an assistant. And he said, how about a holiday? And I said, that'd be great. And he said, fantastic, you're fired. So I went home and had a couple of drinks, as you do when you're lamenting your future. Mm-hmm. And I rang my mother and said, look, you know, the property market's going okay. I've just lost my job. I think we might get into renovating property. You want to come in and join me? Because she was a designer. And she said, Troy, I just want to let you know you're not very handy. So either way, I didn't take her advice. We went and renovated 13 properties over the next 18 months. Her as the interior decorator and designer and me as the guy who did the deals, and actually made four times what I made the year before in radio. And that kind of launched my business career. We still had no clue what we were doing, but we at least had a bit of money behind us now. So we were a bit more dangerous than we were when we had no money. And I suppose in a really weird way, started to buy and sell and trade companies because I had this unusual knack to find things that were broken and then work out how to fix them.
Mm-hmm. And so when you take kind of that mindset of you having a knack to be able to take something that's broken and fix it, what are you looking for? I mean, because not everything that's broken can kind of be put back together. That's the first thing. And then the second thing is what's like the strategic vision before you invest your time, money, effort, energy, and all that?
Yeah, it's funny. Over the years, that's kind of evolved. In the first couple of instances, when we're looking at trading companies, I would just run in the front door blindly and go, this looks like a good idea. Let's just go and see what happens, you know. And I kind of had a bit of a knack with marketing and a bit of a knack with media, which helped us with some of the positioning and promotion of the companies that we were working with. And that was just blind luck. There's no strategy, there was no vision, there was no understanding of what our purpose was with any of the deals we did. It was just an intuitive feeling that I think I could add some value to it, and away we went. And fortunately, we were right. As the years evolved, all of a sudden I realized that I had to get a little bit smarter about this and look for an understanding of what the business looked like on the way out as we went into them. And that's when we really changed the dial a little bit and actually started to make some decent money out of the trades. Before that, we were doing okay. We lucked out, I suppose, in a lot of instances. But when I really understood strategy and understood how to look forward in the business and And I know what I thought its real enterprise value was going to be with the things we could do or change. That's when we actually started to really make some decent money on some of the trades that we did.
So when you're like assessing the real enterprise value and you know that you're going to have, you know, a 3 to 4 year play before you implement an exit strategy, like what are you, I mean, like, I, and generally speaking, what are you looking for? What's appetizing versus, you know, kind of what's sexy at the time, but doesn't have, you know, longevity.
Yeah. It for me, it's not about even having an understanding of the industry. I mean, we've bought in real estate, we've bought into pizza restaurants, into technology, into a number of different industries that I didn't really have much of an understanding of nor any experience in. But the fundamentals were the same in each and every one of them. And that was understand that you need good people, you need a good product, you need a good positioning of that product, you need a good process to be efficient and effective. And you need to understand what the purpose is that you're going into the business for so that you can get out of it. And one of my very early business mentors said to me, never fall in love with a deal or an asset. And I think that was pretty helpful to me over the years, where I always went into it on the basis that we knew we were going to get out of it and we had a purpose for that whole process in the deal. So it wasn't because I loved it or I was excited or was sexy. It was just because I felt that there was something that we could add as a point of value to the development of that business and the next generation of that business. And that was what kind of gave us the direction as to which businesses we'd get into and which we'd kind of pass on.
So I was recently having a conversation with somebody who's a serial angel investor in the tech space, and he was mentioning that, you know, a lot of the companies nowadays are just hyperinflated because you have a lot of people who are coming to the game late, and they're quick to being like, I love it, and they fall in love so fast without one having an understanding of, I believe, the five P's which you just mentioned, and then also having an understanding of, you know, what's the real long-term play or what's the technology play that goes beyond maybe this quote dating app or something like that. And so you have a lot of people buying into something that's not real.
Well, that's right. And I think that there's a real differentiation between what we call smart money and dumb money. Mm-hmm. The dumb money is I'm excited. It's sexy. It's interesting. I want to be part of that. I want to be able to say to my mates over a dinner table and a bottle of wine that I was part of that startup and aren't I clever because I got that right. The smart money is, can I really add some enterprise value to this business in the short term and pop out with a reasonable outcome where I can make a few dollars and then reinvest it in something else and not want to be a superhero, just want to be able to find a path that says this is kind of safe but a little bit edgy and I'm not going to lose the house over it. That's the difference.
So when you're deploying this kind of like smart money mentality, I'm sure your hit rate is a lot higher than, you know, the dumb money hit rate. What kind of value are you looking to add? I mean, because that's like when I lived in San Francisco and I was talking to like hardcore VC people, it's always what value from the network of companies we've invested in can we, you know, do this thing to make this company more profitable than it is before. So what kind of value are you trying to add to something that maybe you don't have any familiar with within the industry or maybe you do have a lot of familiarity with?
Well, the interesting thing for me is that I come from a media and marketing background before I got into private enterprise. And so I kind of look at a business and say, well, if I was a consumer, what would I want? What would I like to be told? What would be a sexy positioning for me? What would be something that's attractive to me to buy that product or service? And I think what happens along the way with a lot of companies is we get too close to it and we forget to think like the people we're trying to serve. And by way of example, a technology company we bought in 2001, right after the tech wreck, they had great technology, they had a really cool product, they had some really smart people in the business, but they were talking like technology guys. I mean, everything was a, you know, an acronym or a hip word or a buzzword or a saying. And so when they were pitching to CEOs, the CEO would sit in front of them with glazed eyes and go, you're patronizing me and you're not talking to me, you're talking at me. And so the simplicity of that play was to walk into the business and say, you need to talk to me like I'm your customer, because I am. I don't understand what we do. I think it's sexy, but I'm not quite sure. But the way you're positioning it to me as a consumer has gone right over my head. And as a result, we're not making any sales. So talk to me like I'm your customer. I am not going to learn what we sell. I'm not going to learn this industry deliberately so that I can be the last test between us and the consumer to make sure we're getting through to them. And that was exactly what happened. We changed our marketing. We shifted the positioning of the business. The business was losing $60,000 a month when we bought it. We had it back in the black in 90 days and put it back on the market 3 years later with a PricewaterhouseCoopers valuation of just under $8 million. And we paid $250,000 for it. So it was a good strategy, but really, really basic. You know, there's no rocket science in there. It's just really just thinking like a consumer and how they want to be spoken to.
I think you hit the nail on the head when you said that people get too close. They get too bought into the idea of what they have without, you know, removing themselves and taking the 30,000 foot view. So kind of from that,
vantage point.
Thank you. You know, what can people do to kind of decouple their view of their business, to take a look back and to really kind of reframe the way that they think about their business, so that way they can actually grow it in ways that maybe they didn't think were possible before?
Yeah, there's an age old saying that you've got to look outside in, and it's pretty simple, really. You know, you come to work every day, you work 12, 14, 16, 18 hours a day. And you go so hard that you're more focused on what I refer to as avoiding the accident rather than the strategy of winning the race. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm an amateur race car driver. I love racing cars. I'm not a very good race car driver, but I love it. And my instructor and co-driver continues to tell me to focus on the strategy of winning the race, not on avoiding the accident. In other words, stop looking at the stuff that's right in front of you and look further down the track at things that you maybe have forgotten to look for or have forgotten that are important to the business. And that then gives you a stronger consumer view of what you're trying to achieve. So you're removing yourself from what you know to be true and what you are used to saying and doing every single day, and looking at it as if you've never seen it before, as if you've never been exposed to the product or service you're trying to sell, and then trying to understand how a consumer would relate to your positioning of that product or service, because sometimes we're a little bit too slick, and it's a routine and a habit we get into because it's familiar to us, but not those we choose to serve.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, you jokingly said when you started you didn't really have a vision. You know, there was a lot of luck. But now that you're in the role that you're in and the type of work that you do and the books you write, you know, how important is it for a business to have a vision?
Oh, look, I think it's incredibly important. And I think what happens is we go into business with a bit of a romance of working for ourselves and believing that we don't have to answer to anybody, and isn't that going to be great, and we're going to make all this money, and we've got this fantastic idea, and it's going to be just this, you know, wonderful journey that we're going to pop out the back end and have fast cars and big houses and everything's going to be fine. I seriously did not start making any real money out of any of the businesses we had until I understood what it looked like when it was finished. And it will be finished. And I think we've got to understand that there is a time and place and space in every business that you're going to get out of it. And a box is not how you get out of it. Your death is not how you get out of a business. You've got to find a way that there's a legacy that you might leave for your family or at least yourself to be able to say, I am going to enjoy the fruits of my labor and the hard work I put into it. And when I started to understand what that time and place and space was, it changed the entire perspective of the companies that we were trading, such that they were now working for me. I was not working for them. These things were now a tool for my future, not a burden. I wasn't in love with them. I wasn't attached to them. They weren't a noose around my neck. They were, in fact, a tool to help me understand what was important in life and how to really get a handle on what I refer to as life blend, how I can get my companies to do what I want them to do for me and my family so that I can enjoy some of the hard work that I've, you know, outlaid over the last 20 years.
So is another word for that work-life balance? Is that what you're
saying? A little bit, but I think when you talk about balance, you have this impression or this vision that it's either yin or yang. When you talk about blend, it's more of an understanding that you're going to go to work. It's going to be challenging. There are going to be days that you love it and hate it. And it's going to have an impact on your family at some point for whatever reason. So the blend is to understand how to compartmentalize your life and know how to get both of those things done effectively and efficiently, such that neither of them have any sort of negative impact on what you're trying to achieve in life. And I'm really specific. Every day I kind of wake up and look at how I can compartmentalize my day, so I've got plenty of time for what I need to get done from a business perspective, but also from a family perspective, and that neither of those things are adversely impacted because of a yin or a yang on a balanced scale. It's more of a blend of the two working together to achieve the end result.
So one of the things that you just mentioned a moment ago is that you don't fall in love, kind of with these companies, and in doing so that they work for you, you don't work for them. And so what I'm curious about is, you know, as you have this vision towards a successful exit, you know, when is the time that most people, you know, try to cut out the negative? I mean, you look at a lot of these businesses and they just kind of like ride them into the ground, and they don't think of, like, you know, this investment that you made just in the long term isn't the right deal. So when is it the right time to cut your losses and just pivot into, you know, some more advantageous position moving forward?
Really good point, because I think what happens in a lot of small businesses, or small medium enterprise even, is that owners or founders stay too long in the business and they get jaded, or they get complacent, or they're just done with it. And the business is already in decline well before they even see it or notice it. And to a prospective suitor or buyer, they're seeing that. So for me, I always try and leave something on the table for the next guy, so that I've got to a point in place and space where I'm happy with it. I think we've made a reasonable addition in enterprise value. I think that it's enough time that we've spent in it where I'm not bored with it, I'm not complacent, I'm not jaded, and the next guy can look over the back fence and go, hey, look, I've got some really cool ideas for this company. If I did this, this, and this, I reckon I could take it to the next level. I want them to come in excited and to be inspired to do the things that they believe I have not yet done, because that then gives them that blue sky opportunity that potentially lifts the enterprise value, because they're prepared to fall in love with the idea that they can do so much better than I have. And I'm okay with that, because I'm certainly not the smartest guy in the room, but I know at what point I become unsmart so that I've got to get out, because I know when I've reached my limit that there's probably not a lot more I can do here. Mm-hmm. And so it's time for me to move on.
I think that's like a very eloquent and beautiful thing, because you start to see like a lot of founders and tech companies, but even, you know, small to medium sized companies that have just been around for a long time. They're so in love with the idea and what they've built that they don't see kind of the pitfalls coming at them that, you know, an outside observer sees.
And I think you're right. I mean, if you look at Silicon Valley right now, and I won't name names, but there are a number of CEOs that I certainly wouldn't invest in. Mm-hmm. And even though they've got incredibly successful companies, I just look at them and go, you guys just shouldn't be running this stuff, because you're just not that smart. Mm-hmm. You had a great idea. You took it to a fantastic IPO. It's made you a lot of money. But seriously, step aside and let somebody who's got some experience to take it to the next game, because I just think it's it's inevitable that sooner or later you're going to trip over, and it's going to be spectacular.
I will say, without naming the company, that I because I've purposely left it off my LinkedIn, and I have thrown away all my free swag shirts, so it's kind of hard to figure out who this company is, because I was kind of embarrassed. But if you had a conversation with the founders, like everybody else in the company, whether it's the HR person who, you know, helped recruit me and everything else, super bought in, super all about the company. Then you go to talk to the founders and you're like, huh? And then you come to find out just recently that they took a bunch of money from investors so that they could kick them out of the company, because they had a very myopic vision of what the company could be, and they didn't think about what the technology and how it could be applied outside of that, and it was ruining them.
Right, they just haven't got the legs as CEOs. They've not had the experience. They haven't got the scars. They haven't had the the street value that they can add to the enterprise value of the business. And I mean, this is one of the things that I know that I have got. It's street value. I'm a street fighter. I have been since the late 80s. I know I'm not the smartest guy in the room. In fact, I never went to college, so I didn't have the grades to get into college, but I know I can duke it out in the streets with the best of them. And I know that pivotal moment when I have reached my limit and I've got to find smarter guys to help me either get to the next game or get out and hand it to a smarter guy to take it to the next game themselves.
You know, when I think of you, Troy, and knowing you over the years, when I hear your name, I always think of franchising. And I know you've been both a franchisor and a franchisee. And I'm just curious what some of the challenges and differences are from those two different vantage points.
Yeah, it's funny. I fell into franchising in the late 80s. One of our clients was about to franchise their business. And he said, you know about franchising, Troy, don't you? I said, absolutely I do. And I remember leaving the meeting and ringing the office saying, go buy some books on franchising. We had no clue. But then no one else did either in the 80s. And so it was kind of easy to kind of bluff your way through. But I had this consulting business for a number of years. We consulted to about 300 different franchise brands in 16 different countries around the world. So it was a good little business. And along the way, we invested in a couple of franchisors that we were working with as a franchisee. So I've been a franchisee twice. And here's the interesting pivot. As a consultant, I could see both sides of the fence, franchisor or franchisee. But as soon as I became a franchisee, I forgot all that. Mm-hmm. It was just all about me and my business and why aren't you doing more for me and it's your job and, you know, I'm paying your fees and how come you can't support me? And it was kind of funny. It actually took me a while to sit back and introspectively look at the way I was handling that position and remind myself that I knew that this was a partnership between franchisor and franchisee. And I knew that I had a responsibility in that as a franchisee, even though I was an investor, not, you know, day to day, I had a responsibility to run and manage and grow that business as much as the franchisor did. And now, more recently, as an investor in a franchisor business here in the United States, I see the other side of the fence more literally because, again, even though I haven't got a day job in that business, I have a board position and I deal with the high-end issues in that relationship between franchisor and franchisee. And I have to keep reminding myself that my job, again, is to be a partner in that relationship, not somebody that's just there to serve, but one who's there to partner with them to grow our businesses collectively for the future. It's been a challenge, even though I've been in it for 25 years now. You know?
So I did a lot of work with one of my previous employers with regards to quick serve or fast casual kind of QSR franchises. And I can say that the holding company that owned multiple different brands, those were some of the most entertaining phone calls because they like it was the most crass kind of, they're from Pennsylvania, like all of them, like it's just like, man, you know, whatever. And then all of a sudden, once it flipped to okay, now we're talking business, those guys were on. And like they understood everything from cook time to from order time to delivery and cook and like they wanted to know operations and how if they implemented our solution, is it going to cause them to be backed up 15 seconds per order? Because if that does happen, that's going to be a huge problem. And it was militant in how it was broken down. And then on the flip side, what they talked about was that a lot of these franchisees come in and they just think it's turnkey and they can just make the monetary investment and quote be a business owner when in reality I'm saying it myself, they never said this, but they're kind of too scared to start their own company, so they buy into something that's a little bit proven and just requires a little bit of work. So I'm wondering if you could talk about that, especially when, you know, maybe somebody wants to open a franchise in an area that's kind of like away from the franchise hub.
Yeah, look, the industry's changed a bit in recent years with private equity moving into the sector more and more. So you end up with, like as you point out, a collective group of different franchise systems living under the one roof. And that's in part a good thing because there's a sharing of resource and experience and ideas and innovation. But in part, it's also a little bit disruptive because everyone has a slightly different way to that they need to run those franchise systems. from my perspective, if you're looking to come outside in to a franchise group, maybe you're a middle manager that, you know, is sick of your job, or you've had a redundancy, or, you know, you've just decided you won't be on your own in business, look for the systems that you have an interest in, that you believe you could actually add some personal value to that business, because you're not buying yourself a job. You're essentially trying to find a path to grow your own little empire. And that means you've got to have a passion or an interest in what you do, because you're going to be doing it every day, and you're going to be doing it for 12 and 14 and 16 hours a day. And you're going to have the great support of a franchise system to help you do that. But at the end of the day, it's still your business. It's your responsibility. It's your company. And I think that's where a lot of people coming into the franchise sector miss the point. Franchising gives you the support of something that's proven, a process, a system, and some value. But it doesn't replace sweat. It doesn't replace the hard work and the effort you've got to put in as a business owner to grow and develop that business at the pace that you feel you need to deliver the outcome that you seek.
I think that's a kind of a brilliant point that you made, is like a lot of these are just systems. I mean, I don't want to say turnkey insofar that if you just make the investment, the money will be printed, because it's obviously it can't be that easy, because if it was, everybody would be doing it. But you know, these are, for the most part, if it's a proven franchise model, it's a system that works. I mean, you get the brand, you get the marketing behind the brand, you get everything. All you have to do is just, you know, put the money down and work.
Well, and you've also got to make sure that you have the support of the people around you. One of the big things that we look for, we're in the pool industry. We have a retail and mobile service pool business in the franchise sector, a company called Poolworks. It's got 100 stores in Australia and 25 here. We've only been here for 2 years. And we've got 120 mobile units running around. So it's a relatively good business, and it's a relative size of a business. But everybody that we interview to join us as a franchise partner, I want to interview their family as well. I want to make sure that their spouse is involved, that everyone understands that there's going to be a sacrifice of time and energy to grow that company. And we're not going to fix it for them. We're going to help them on their journey. But at the end of the day, everyone has to be behind it. And I think one of the key things with anyone moving into private enterprise, whether it's franchising or not, is to get that support of your spouse, because it's going to be hard, and there will be some good days and some bad days. And without that support, then you have this revolving door of, I'm stressed and angry at work, I'm stressed and angry at home, and it just keeps getting worse and worse. And that's not good for anybody at the end of the day. You need to understand that you are not alone in business, and certainly franchising provides that for you in part from a system, process, and support point of view.
Gosh, how do you – are there challenges with having franchisees in Australia and in the U.S. and everything being so geographically dispersed?
Yeah, it's interesting. We've worked in 16 different countries as consultants over the years, and not a day goes by where I haven't got a franchisee from somewhere in the world say to me, yeah, but you don't get it. It's different for me in my area.
Okay.
Yeah, my city, my country, my customers. Yeah, my customers are different. They're taller, they're shorter, they're richer, they're poorer. There's always something that they believe is different in their part of the world. And here's the interesting thing: over the years, what we've learned to understand is it's not different. Consumers are the same all over the world. They want a number of key transactional drivers from you in any business. They want quality, they want service, they want a relationship, they want it to be easy. And if you can deliver those things as transactional drivers, you offer them the perception of value, and therefore it's not different for you. So for me, one of the bigger challenges I have is not understanding the geographic or socioeconomic differences between countries or cities or states. It's really understanding how to communicate that to the franchise partners we have in those cities or states or countries, to have them understand that the challenges they have as a business owner in Tennessee are exactly the same as Townsville in Australia, or, you know, somewhere in Europe. It's not any different. They just need to look at it from their perspective and maybe look at the slight change or the idiosyncrasies they have to apply in their world to what we know to be true as real and important transactional drivers that need to be apparent in the eyes of your consumer. So it's more a positioning to the franchisee than it is a positioning to the consumer as to how they deliver that value to those they choose to serve.
So taking that idea and pulling on that thread a little bit more, when you're investing in a company and you're getting pushback from maybe an idea that you want to implement, and they're saying, hey, you don't understand my customers, my industry, this, yeah, that, and the other, it's the same thing, right?
It is. And so, again, I try and put these guys in the perspective of the consumer. So with any of the companies that we've consulted to, or the companies, in fact, that we've bought, I sit down with the staff and say, if you were a consumer of this product or service, how would you view us? What would you look at? What would you think would be important? And pretend that you don't know anything about what we do or why we should be important to them, what value we can bring to them. And let's just break it right down to the basic communication of, how are you going to improve my life as somebody you're looking to serve? Because if you can't communicate that, then you pretty much haven't got anything to sell. At the end of the day, you need to talk to me like I'm a five-year-old to have me understand that you've got some value in my life. And that's all I care about, particularly in the last 10 years with the advent of social media and this clutter that we have in our lives of the amount of messages that we get delivered every day. We have to cut through that clutter by saying, what value are you going to deliver to me as a consumer? And if I don't get it quickly and efficiently in a really short period of time, I'm going to move on to the next opportunity.
So when you were talking about the companies that you invested in, you said, I want to paraphrase it. I think you said something like, you intentionally don't understand maybe the company or the industry. You want them to be able to tell it to you because and please expand on this, but my guess is that you kind of go back to like the five P's that you mentioned earlier, and which I had them written down, but I know what you're talking about when you do that, but like, it's all the same. Tell me how you can add value, right? Like, is that what you're thinking?
It is. It is. So let's use the pool industry as a business, as an example. You know, I've been part of this business for 20 years, first as a consultant and now as a shareholder in the business here in the United States. I'm on the board of directors in Australia and in America. It's a $100 million business. It's a great little company. And still, 20 years down the track, I deliberately do not learn about the equipment we sell, the chemicals we sell, about water testing, about water balancing. I have never cleaned a pool, and I have no intention of cleaning a pool or even selling something in one of our retail stores. And that's deliberate, and it's by design, because I want to be the guy that they're trying to sell stuff to and have them really sit in front of me and pitch it to me as if I've got no clue, because that's how we gain new clients.
You know, what's funny is I never prepare for these. And by these, I mean the podcast, because I want you, the speaker, to tell me everything about you.
And that's because I'm not interesting. That's why I never prepared. You know, you probably looked at my webpage and said, I don't want to know about this guy.
I mean, yeah. I was just stoked that we're LinkedIn friends. I'm like, cool, we have six mutuals. But I intentionally, even when I was doing speaker vetting here, I would intentionally not do quote homework, because I want to hear the story. Sure. I want to hear the passion, the charisma, and everything else, because then it makes it easier to sell the speaker.
Here's an extension of that for you. I have never read a resume of anybody I've employed in 25 years.
Are you serious?
I used to do the same thing.
Yep. And here's why. No one has a bad resume. No one says, you know what, I suck at that.
Yeah.
And you should know that. Uh-huh. And so typically I get my HR guys or my senior leadership team to read the resumes and vet it. I'm the last guy they talk to before we consider employing them. And I sit in front of them on the desk, their resumes in front of me, and I say, tell me your story. Because if you can't tell me your story, to your point, Kyle, with passion and with excitement and enthusiasm and reality and authenticity, then you're clearly lying in your resume.
That's awesome.
Oh, you know, great minds think alike. I'm available for hire, Troy. Let's do this.
Awesome.
I won't do any prep work, though. Just letting you know.
And I won't read your resume either.
Cool.
I can guarantee you.
Awesome.
I think you guys would be a great pair. That
Signing the contract
awesome.
Over now.
Troy, in your speech, I know you talk about crashing the party. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. So everyone's having a conversation about us, and most times we just don't know it. And when I say that, I don't mean that personally. I mean that about our companies and our businesses that we're looking to promote. Social media has given consumers a whole new dimension to be able to do their homework, to find out about us and do that research well before we're even invited to join the conversation. So one of our most important jobs, I think, is to try and crash the party. And while I believe social media is a great tool for us, I don't believe it's going to change the world. It's for me, it's no different than radio was in the 40s, television in the 60s, the internet in the 80s. It's just the next iteration of a communication tool that we have. And we have to approach it differently to the other tools that we've been exposed to over the last 50, 60 years. You know, television, radio, and those sort of tools were all push tools. They pushed a message out into the ether and hoped that consumers would pick up on that and in turn respond to it and come and buy stuff from us. Social media is an interactive tool that we need to be a part of that conversation, where we're actively going out there and seeking to join the conversation and crash the party when we haven't been invited. Because I think that's the opportunity a lot of small businesses miss. They think they can just do an SEO campaign or an SEM campaign or some sort of Facebook ads or whatever, and everything will be fine. I can let it sit aside and people will find me. It's just another tool. I believe that we have to actively go out there and engage with consumers where they are looking for us, even though we've not been invited to join the conversation. We have to crash the party. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not a digital expert, nor am I a social media expert, but I do know that in our companies, when we have deliberately gone out there and gone one step beyond just a digital campaign and an SEM or an SEO campaign and tried to actively engage and crash the party, we've had a tremendous success with it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the next generation of digital marketing that people need to consider.
Yeah, when I was working out in Silicon Valley in New York, you know, a lot of these, early stage kind of startups and even late stage startups, you know, they have the keywords plugged into Twitter and LinkedIn and whatnot, and they're looking for people talking about something like that. And then you're doing all of this social selling where you're direct messaging or you're replying to something and saying, hey, here's how I can add value. You know, hit me up if you need any help. And that's how we did a lot of our kind of outbound marketing as a sales team, was going out and finding people, you know, chatting about something that's, you know, relatively related to what it is that we're doing. And those tend to be, oh man, wow, I didn't realize people were reading this. I'm like, yeah, well, hey, great, let's do a phone call. And it was some of the best, easiest deals. And it's just kind of like out there.
Well, look, we travel a lot. We have two young children, a 6-year-old and a 4-year-old. And our 4-year-old is celiac. She's allergic to gluten. So when we travel, my wife does a lot of research on hotels that have gluten-free kitchens. And so we know that she will be safe in those travels. The amount of research that Dominique, my wife, does online is extraordinary. And it's interesting, the hotels and the people who engage us on a proactive basis and crash the party are the ones that always get our business. And they are also some of the most popular hotels for people with that particular disease or condition. Mm-hmm. So I suppose the simplicity of that is that fish where the people are fishing, and be the first guy there with the bait, crash that party.
Love that.
So, you know, you wrote a book called Future Proofing Your Business, and I kind of want to segue this into what coming down the funnel for the next 5 years are some of the challenges that small to medium-sized companies are facing, and what can companies do to future-proof themselves so that way those hurdles, roadblocks, or barriers just are minimized or non-existent?
Yeah, it's funny. You write a book called Future Proofing Your Business, and all of a sudden everybody thinks you're a futurist. and really, I'm just a realist. I'm not a futurist. Mm-hmm. And the realist in me says the biggest problem we have in business is that we forget. We forget what we've learned in previous business and economic cycles. And as a result, we live the same cycle again. So by way of example, 2008 was a big hit for everybody. And everyone goes, wow, I'm so glad that's finished. You know, we can move on with life and business is good now. And I'm glad that's behind us. Well, look, the reality is right now we are overdue for an economic correction. Mm-hmm. The Dow Jones at 21,000 is not to be celebrated, because somewhere amongst that, something is artificial and we will see an economic correction. It won't be politically driven. It'll just be the way we do things as humans. We are either greedy or we're fearful. And we drive the economy either into the ground or through the roof. That's just what we do. And it comes through every 7 to 10 years, and the same cycle happens again and again. So small business and small medium enterprise just needs to be remind themselves of what they've learned. What did you do in 2008 What can you learn from that, learn from the past to apply to the present to protect yourself for the future? It's as simple as that. I mean, I lived through two recessions in 1987 and again in the mid-90s with the Asian crisis. And collectively, those two recessions or economic shifts, significant shifts, cost me about probably $1.5 million. By the time I got to the tech wreck in 2001, we got smarter and bought into technology after the bubble. And then in 2008, we got out of everything before the crash came around, knowing that it was artificial. We were sitting on a bunch of cash and able to dive back into business where we saw opportunity after everyone was trying to find their way through the rubble. And it wasn't that I was clever. It wasn't that I'm just this genius futurist. It's just simply because finally, after 15 years of getting it wrong, I remembered the past, applied it to the present to protect ourselves from the future, to the future. Mm-hmm. It's as simple as that.
Well, if anything is true, history is prologue. So, look, if y'all want to book Troy Hazard, you can do so by contacting GDA Speakers. The phone number to contact us is 214-420-1999. The website's gdaspeakers.com. How clever. Then if you want the book, transcripts, and anything else with regards to today's podcast, go to gdapodcast.com.
Thank you, Troy. It was great catching up with you.
Thanks, Troy.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks for listening to this episode of GDA Podcast, powered by GDA Speakers. If you're interested in booking today's guest, visit GDA Speakers at gdaspeakers.com or call 214-420-1999. Visit gdapodcast.com and subscribe to our newsletter to stay up to date and be informed of new episodes, blog posts, and more. Be sure to follow GDA Podcast on Twitter and Instagram at GDA Podcast, as well as Facebook at facebook.com/GDA Podcast. Thanks again, and stay tuned for more from GDA Podcast and GDA Speakers.